Hey, fellow Montrezl Harrell stands. Welcome to Luxury Tax, the only podcast where illegal streaming is readily encouraged. I'm Logan.
And I'm Maxwell. You can catch us here every Wednesday on the Lead Sports Media, as well as the Spotify and Anchor app. Boys and girls, princes and paupers, the feeble and the meek. Welcome to Luxury Tax, come one, come all. Now, we don't care if you just spent $70 to wear a Supreme hoodie at a Mav concert, or if you're fighting for your Dodge Charger in a messy divorce. We love to have you here. Logan, I'm told you just finished up a fives run at Harbor. How'd it go?
Yeah, my endorphins running pretty high. I'm pretty jacked, but not as jacked as Steve Ballmer was earlier today at that press conference. I mean, he looked like he just ran through a Colombian cocaine factory and drank two Red Bull at it. Oh my God.
No, Steve was powdered to the gills. And you could see it. You could see in Paul George's eyes where he got the stuff. Now, listen, Steve Ballmer has the type of fuck you money where he could have gotten up there and just undone his trousers and started, you know, making like a rabid dog in terms of saliva emitting from his mouth, and the press conference would have been equally well received.
As long as he doesn't venture into the territory that the old Clippers owner does, I think he's fine.
No, right. Racism off limits. Shouting maniacally, totally cool. As long as you're Steve Ballmer.
Uh-huh.
Now, I'm told that we are entering into the dog days of the NBA summer. No disrespect to the Pau Gasol Blazers signing today, nor the rumors of a Bradley Beal extension, but this isn't exactly Woj bomb news. This is more like a Woj flamethrower, so to speak, or a Woj warning shot.
Okay, flare gun per se.
Yeah, it's a Woj flare gun. So what we really want to dive into in this episode is wrapping up Summer League. What impressed us from Summer League? Who were the players who really stood out and feel like, you know, you look at the body of work they put in and you're like, that's an NBA player. You know, that guy can work into the rotation and make an impact off the bench immediately. Who were those guys for you?
So starting off, the Summer League MVP in Brandon Clark and carried the Grizzlies to a Summer League championship. I mean, every single game, I don't think he ever played more than like 25 minutes, but made every single minute count, especially on the defensive end. Just really just like a savant in terms of defensive rotations, always in position, always contesting shots at the rim, always elevating very quickly, and really providing a lot on offense in terms of his footwork down low, lob threats, like putbacks, tips, etc. You know, it's a little concerning with Clark to see just like the lack of an outside game, but in terms of everything else, he was by far the most impressive rookie that I saw at Summer League, and really just the best player on the court in most games at Vegas. So, Brandon Clark was my MVP of Summer League as well. I think the media got that one right. Who they surprisingly left off both the first and second teams was Carson Edwards of the Celtics.
Right.
And Carson Edwards was damn good in Summer League. I mean, he hit some shots that I have not seen a guy hit in Summer League since, man. Like Bradley Beal, maybe? I don't know. I haven't seen a guy play like what Edwards did in Summer League in a very long time, but he was coming off screen, still moving, hitting the three. He was getting to the rim and Kyrie-esque finishes. He was doing it all, and he really impressed me. I was shocked that he got left off of both the first and second team Summer League teams. Another guy that impressed me was Mifiondu Cabangeli, originally from Chicago.
For sure.
He was a sophomore at Florida State last year. His shot has really, really impressed me in Summer League. At Florida State, it was really iffy. Some games he would like take like four or five, then he would go like a three-game stretch without shooting a three. But his stroke is passable, and he moves off ball really well. especially for his size. Like, he's always kind of spotting up top of the key area, and they're letting him take it. He was letting it fly. He was hitting it. And then on the defensive end, we saw some similar things to Brandon Clark, not to that same extent, but great body positioning. He climbs the ladder as well. And, yeah, I liked what I saw out of Cabangeli.
Yeah, Cabangeli was definitely on my short list. I mean, he put up – it was 17-7 in six games, 6 of 12 from three. But the most like, noticeable element was how he's starting to understand how to utilize his length and the timing of his jumps to affect shots at the rim.
Uh-huh.
That was something where I think at Florida State, he kind of zoned in and out because they had other defensive specialists on that team who were kind of locking things down on D. I love what I saw from Cabangeli. I'm still skeptical how much of an impact he can have on this, you know, loaded Clippers roster. I hate to bite the bullet here. I really hate to give myself a taste of my own medicine, but I mean, I'll be real. Nikhil Alexander Walker was electric. Absolutely electric. Yeah. I mean, he put on an absolute clinic of step backs and crossover combinations, just like getting to the rim in such a diverse array of forms. I never saw this from him. Like, and I think the biggest criticism was oh, you just didn't watch him. No, I did watch him. He wasn't even the best guard on his team in college. I never saw any of this. And he came out, his pick and roll chemistry with Jackson Hayes was wonderful to watch. I was flabbergasted by Alexander Walker. I thought we've dwelled on Anthony Simons a bit, but the confidence Anthony Simons has started to accumulate with his stroke, especially just quickening his release and extending his range, has been really impressive. I do want to go back to Carson Edwards though, because I probably watched the most Boston Celtics Summer League, and Carson Edwards was nothing short of spectacular. I mean Carson Edwards put on enough. I mean, Carson Edwards, if you watch like the Free Dawkins summer highlights of Carson Edwards, you would believe that this was an 82 game season highlight tape, not a 6 game season highlight tape.
Yeah.
I mean it was that impressive. I mean, he was coming down and drilling 35 footers on a dead sprint in which he is jumping off 2 feet and landing a solid 5 feet in ahead of his original jump. I mean, me and Logan were arguing last night, you know, what's the modern day NBA comp for this guy? Is there any real precedent? I think he reminds me a little bit of a young Jared Bayless. I see a young Jared Bayless, just a guy who his green light is just such an intuitive green light. Like, there's absolutely no hesitation. Another guy is Shane Larkin, who is now playing in Barcelona, okay, but played for the Celtics.
I can see it.
Yeah, I think, like, because Shane Larkin, his Achilles heel was always just an inability to grasp transition defense and perimeter defense. But Shane Larkin had that just explosive sort of green light all the time, go, 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 using a very, like, mechanical, explosive quickness to carve out space and carve out tough shots for him. Mm-hmm.
It seems like the Celtics, like, gravitate towards these small to, like, medium-sized guards with that quick trigger, whether it be, like you said, Shane Larkin, Terry Rozier, and now Carson Edwards. These guys with that internal green light that aren't afraid to let it fly and really don't think twice ever about it.
Even Marcus Smart, honestly. Marcus Smart doesn't hit him, but, like, Marcus Smart just plays with this, like, tenacious ferociousness that I saw in Carson Edwards. Like, I think Danny Ainge does look for some very specific traits and intangibles when he's selecting guards, and I'm a fan of it, to say the least. There's a couple qualms I have about Edwards' game, which is I saw somebody on Twitter was comparing him to Fred VanVleet. Like, this guy, oh, this it was some fucking clown who had like a J. Cole Abby on Twitter spouting off under some House of Hoops tweet. But he's the next Fred VanVleet. And it's like we have this horrific habit of grouping all undersized guards into one archetype, like Fred VanVleet.
Or Isaiah Thomas.
And yeah, or as oh yeah, no, yeah, he's Nate Robinson. Like, okay, like you have the depth perception to see basic height, like A plus, right? But the thing that made Fred VanVleet such an alluring prospect out of college, even coming undrafted, at least what I thought was, this guy has premier elite pick and roll instincts in terms of timing and distribution off the pick and roll. And at Wichita State, he showed elite catch and shoot potential, right? Carson Edwards has never been a catch and shoot player, right? He's always been a like off the dribble, carve out outrageously tough looks that happen to go in type of player. And he's also never really functioned in a pick and roll system. He's always been like the go-to volume scorer type guy. Like, you're taking 25 shots a game, a lot of it in isolation. And so part of me is scared that, I we've just never seen, like, Jared Bayless being early Jared Bayless being maybe the one exception. We've never seen this work in the modern NBA.
Now, Grant, we haven't seen a lot of guys in the NBA period that have been able to do this. And whether it's a product of the like lack of flow of summer league games and the lack of practice that allowed Carson Edwards to do what he did and excel, who knows? But I do think that with Carson Edwards going against bench units, he will definitely benefit from playing against these a little bit less electric, less athletic bench units that probably haven't watched as much film on him in comparison to starting units that are used to at least seeing Kyrie's, that are used to seeing Lillard's, they're used to seeing Westbrook's, you know?
Definitely, definitely, and I guess like the big defense, like, to play devil's advocate to my original argument, the big defense that I have for Edwards is his ability to score off balance, to hit tough off balance shots, is, whether or not it's, a little dicey, it is an elite NBA skill, right? It is a skill that he's achieved true mastery of. And like, that's kind of the discussion I wanted to dive into here is I'm starting to see a trend amongst the plebeian media of this wretched, wretched word called versatility that has become like the buzzword on, oh, it's like it's Bleacher Report, it's the undefeated, it's SB Nation. Every top 10 list is it's versatility. He's such a dynamic presence. He can guard 1 through 5, right? And I look at some young guys who are struggling. I look at a guy like Josh Jackson. I look at a guy like Mo Bamba. I look at a lot of guys who are even a guy like Ingram, who's had his ups and downs. A lot of guys who were described as their premier potential being derived from their versatility. And I'm starting to have some sincere doubts. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, and I even fall into that trap often of you see an athletic guy, you see him with some savvy playmaking skills once in a while, generally inconsistent on the offensive end, and you describe him as like a Swiss Army knife. Oh, he's versatile, he'll work it out. He has two all these skills, he's good. But like in reality what you're saying is he's not elite at anything. He doesn't have one tangible or two tangible skills that are going to make him a productive player in a rotation for you.
Right. No, that's exactly it. And I mean, if we look at what the modern NBA has become, who were the teams who, not just flat out contended this year, but like at the end of the year, we're clearly like, in all the advanced metrics, putting up the most efficient sort of scoring. It was teams that had very clear-cut role definition. Like before this year started, Bill Simmons was wailing on his keyboard saying, "Oh, the Celtics are going to win 67 games. Tatum's going to take the leap. Smart's going to have a great year. Jaylen Brown, here we come." Right? And why did that team struggle? Because all of these different guys had such expansive skill sets that they all tried to utilize simultaneously. A team like the Raptors, you know, Danny Green knows exactly what he had to do, and that was delineated throughout the entire season. Serge Ibaka, his precise movements, you know, his precise diagonal cuts, his precise like 15-foot spot ups, everything was choreographed. You know, these guys were chosen as, like, you know, outsourced mercenaries. They were henchmen. And really, I mean, if you look at just the assemblage of that team, how it was pieced together. And I think there's a case to be made for role definition and just the reversion back to the true specialist. You know, not that we have to have a whole league of Reddicks and Corvers, you know, or what have you, or back to like just the, you know, the Bill Laimbeer 90s enforcer hockey style centers.
No, I don't think we're going to see that again, but
you know, but I think there's something to be said for like pre-scripted role definition that helps accentuate the flow of the game and helps people understand where to focus their energy once things get chaotic.
Yeah, and how to regroup once you're losing steam, once you're losing momentum. Okay, we can fall back on the Danny Green corner three. We can fall back on the Marcus Saul like passing instincts from the top of the key. We can fall back, and obviously you can fall back in Kawhi, but no, you're definitely right, and I like to use the Raptors for an example as a team that has been constructed with role identities in mind, and the Celtics being the antagonistic example of that, in which you have like 14 wings that are all very good, that all think that they can make the offense run. And what ends up happening is you have an offense that does not have chemistry, that fans can't rally behind, because you can't like shout out when Danny Green hits it. Oh, Danny Green, bang. Or like with the Bucks, like you get Malcolm Brogdon in the corner, you know, it's automatic. You know, when Giannis kicks it out to Pat Connaughton in the second unit, you know, that's automatic, you know?
Yeah. No, I mean, and the Bucks are another good example. Like, hey, end of the shot clock, like we can have Giannis go for just an aggressive penetration, or we can sit Middleton down on like the high block, like back down on the elbow and go with a Middleton fadeaway, you know, Bledsoe penetration, Brogdon in the corner. Like the optionality that is offered when you have role players who have elite NBA skills, like a singular elite NBA skill, it gives you an arsenal, right? It gives you like, you know, it just gives you a much wider array of options. Because I feel like for a while, especially like in the Michael Carter Williams, like rookie of the year era, a lot of the whispers from the media and from execs and GMs was, you know, this is where the league is heading. It's going to be, everyone's going to be about 6'10". Everyone's going to be able to handle. Everyone's going to be able to shoot. You know, it's the death of the big man. You know, like, mm-hmm. I mean, if you would have talked to somebody in, you know, 2014, if, you know, Nikola Jokic would be doing what he's doing right now, or Karl Anthony Towns, you know, they would have laughed at you. And yet, We're still seeing a much higher pace to game. We're still seeing, you know, scoring has gone up immensely the past 3 years. But this idea of total positionless basketball, you know, like the everyone is a 6'8" power forward, small forward, playmaking, like
cyborg
point center. Yeah, I think I mistakenly bought into that mythos, and it's starting to unravel before our eyes.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I kind of want to move on to talking about some more guys that impressed the Summer League. We got carried away a little bit there, but
for sure.
I will say that other than rookies, some guys that impressed me, especially Lonnie Walker, was
definitely
absolutely fabulous. I think he only played like 3 or 4 games, but he averaged 30 a game in Summer League and just looked like he really outgrew it.
Six rebounds too, 55% field goal percentage. He was magnetic.
And like what's unfortunate for Lonnie Walker is he's gonna enter next year coming off of an insane summer league, probably recovering from injury from last year. And he's probably going to be buried behind not only DeJounte Murray, but also Derek White at the point guard, the depth chart. And I recently saw a statement
Forget Patty Mills.
Well, yeah, and Patty Mills. So,
And dude, you can't forget Bryn Forbes either.
Well, Bryn Forbes more of a two, but
Lonnie Walker's kind of a two as well.
I don't know what Lonnie Walker is.
Bit of a combo guard, but
I recently saw a statement by Lonnie that said I'm gonna play wherever Pops put me. I've totally bought in, like, which is good to see. But when you have a team that not only has, like I said, DeJounte, Bryn Forbes, Patty Mills, DeMar DeRozan, Bryn Forbes, it's gonna be difficult to see him sitting on the bench for a lot of these games when he just came off of this electrifying summer league performance, when you can see that he developed his offensive game just tremendously in the offseason.
No, absolutely. And I think even like DeRozan's dominance of minutes will stagnate his ability to get pick. Do you think there's any team looking for young guard talent that will make a move for him?
I mean, like the Suns are obviously when it comes to- The Suns are not smart enough. The Suns don't know Lonnie Walker exists yet.
No. The Suns still believe that the Spurs are composed of Manu Ginobili, Tony Parker, Tim Duncan, and Robert Horry.
So, the other team that I look at as a possibility is the Clippers.
Jesus, that is just terrifying.
That's frightening to think about. But when you look at a guy in Patrick Beverley, you look at first-team all-defender who fits in great with the identity that looks like the Clippers are trying to craft for themselves, but you don't have a lot of scoring options at the guard spots other than Lou Williams off the bench. But in terms of, like, point guard creation and just general generation of offense, you're not really getting that right now. And I can see the Clippers at the deadline saying, all right, we'll send you, I don't know, like Tyrone Wallace and a first rounder for Lonnie Walker, you know?
Yeah. I mean, like I don't hate the Jerome Robinson option. Shamet obviously had a great rookie season. Hopefully he can avoid the sophomore slump. Sindarius Thornwell is a bit meh. So, you know, that's, but I don't think Terrence Mann is all that much of a downgrade from Lonnie Walker, given the sort of summer league Terrence Mann had. I mean, Terrence Mann was an animal on the boards and in playmaking in transition.
Terrence Mann was an animal, and his chemistry with Kamigeli was evident right away. Obviously, both come from Florida State. So, like, maybe you're going to see a Clippers bench unit with them working together in the pick and roll. That'd be fun to see. I just can't wait to watch the Clippers this year. I'm going to be real. It's going to be a great time. League Pass is just going to be electric.
Or Reddit streams. Shout out all the hackers.
Yes.
We do. The question that's been overflowing in my Twitter direct mentions is for Logan Colleen's opinion on Tyler Herro's summer league.
Okay, so for as high as everyone is on Herro this summer league, I'm also high on him. I think we need to take a step back and look at what kind of shots he was taking in summer league and the shooting marks he put up in summer league. Now, I don't have exact stats on this, but I don't believe he shot over the 45% mark from the field in summer league. He was taking a lot of tough looks, and they were running a lot of plays to get him, individually him, just open looks, and it worked to a certain extent. But Hero's not a shot creator. He's not really a playmaker. And honestly, like we stated on an earlier podcast, I think the most underrated part of his game is just his defensive instincts, disrupting passing lanes, just general instincts on the perimeter, on the defensive end. But yes, Herro was definitely impressive. But if you're expecting him to like be Miami's savior, as I've seen kind of circulating around, I think we all need to take a step back and really look at what Tyler Herro is as a basketball player.
Right, and I actually, you know, I'll disagree with you partially. I actually think his shot creation was a little bit more refined in summer league than it was at Kentucky. You know, there were some UK fans in the YouTube comments on Free Dawkins who were teeing off with, well, his shot looked great, And even the ones that weren't going in looked really good. You know, that was the line of commentary. Listen, is Tyler Herro going to come in and going to be able to provide like instant scoring support for Jimmy Butler like Josh Richardson did? You know, absolutely not. I don't see him coming in as a rookie and going an efficient 16 or 17. However, can he come in and be a spark? You know, especially with his energy and his attitude, he has that sort of infectious, contagious sort of attitude that either gets under your skin or lights you up, depending on what your demeanor is. I was inspired by his performance. I love his green light attitude. I love how he doesn't back down. I love how he's not scared of the moment.
I love how fluid his shot motion is. It looks so damn smooth. Like there's shooters in college where you're like, okay, I'm not sure this is gonna translate. They come in a rookie year, they shoot like 32, 33% from deep, and it's like, are they going to adjust to the 3-point line in the NBA, the general flow of the game, the different shots that they're getting? And like Tyler Herro, I look at, and I'm not worried at all about his ability to get open looks from three and knock those down. Like, I think he's going to come in day one, like Shamit did last year, and just be like a 38% plus 3-point shooter that can just bomb.
Definitely. No, I could foresee that. I thought another intriguing, overarching storyline from Summer League was how previous NBA experience seemed to be kind of the distinguishing factor when it came to who was able to dominate. Like Cameron Payne gets like, you know, he basically starts his season when he gets picked up off the waiver wire in like mid March, and then plays like 16 minutes a game on like a horrific Suns team or Bulls team. But he was, you know, he was just going off. Mitchell Robinson was a bat out of hell.
Oh my God, it was ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean
So,
Mitchell Robinson single-handedly contested every shot taken by all five players on the court.
I'm gonna read you a stat right now that just supports that theory through and through. The top out of the top 10 point averages, four of them belong to second year guards. Frank
Yeah,
Jackson,
Bruce Brown.
Frank Jackson, Lonnie Walker, Aaron Holiday, Anfernee Simons, Alonzo Trier, Gary Clark. Oh no, that never mind. That's 6 out of 10, not 4 out of 10.
Wow.
So Gary
You didn't
Clark,
even mention. You
Anfernee
didn't.
Simons, Aaron Holiday, Trier, Lonnie Walker, Frank Jackson. Wow.
Yeah.
All at pretty efficient marks from the field too, and like
Definitely.
that's why I'm always quick to kind of throw in the adage of take Summer League like a grain of salt. I mean, you can take some things away from it, but the difference between a second year player, a third year player, especially from the guard spot, and a first year guard in Summer League is it's pretty tremendous.
Well, I mean, and if you look at a guy like even like Chris Boucher, you know, Chris Boucher rarely even suits up for Raptors games. I mean, he is the end of the end of the bench, and he dropped like 22 and 10, you know, on like 45. Like, and he was a G League MVP, you know, and it's like it just goes to show how competitive this league truly is, you know, and how tiny and minuscule like the divide can be between making a roster and being in the G League. The one other guy that I wanted to remark upon, who I was, you know, really overjoyed to see play well, was Jared Vanderbilt. I think Jared Vanderbilt has a real knack for the game that gets undersold. He averaged a 12 and 12 on about 50% shooting, but if you look at like just his confidence in directing traffic, in directing down screen action, in like coaching rookies, even though he's basically a rookie, like I think there's a reason guys around the league really like Jared Vanderbilt, and it's I think he's in kind of the similar position as Lonnie Walker, where he's a young guy who seems primed to explode, but he's on a team that is just goddamn loaded with guys at his position.
I mean, yeah, we're talking about a team that consists of, you know, Torrey Craig. We got Will Barton, and now Jerami Grant, Paul Millsap, Hernan Gomez. Michael Porter Jr. is finally making his debut this year. And then you still have center depth with Jokic and Plumlee. And we'll see what if Bol Bol is, like, healthy or what his deal is. But that is a front court that is almost impenetrable in terms of Jared Vanderbilt being able to work his way in there. Like, barring, like, catastrophic injuries to, like, more than one member of that Nuggets front court, it's going to be a long year riding the pine for Vanderbilt. And, you know, another team could also make a move for him. And the Nuggets could honestly get, like, a late first rounder for Vanderbilt just based on what that we've seen in Summer League in the G League with his rebounding prowess, his just feel for the game in general. But yeah, I was also impressed by Vanderbilt. I mean, there was one rebound that I saw where he was like surrounded by like three different guys, somehow manages it to tip it, then tips it again, chases it down in the corner, throws it behind his back and gets it back for a slam. It was just outstanding. Just there's no quitting this guy.
No, he's got this rare combination of hand eye and spatial awareness. Like his hands, his tactile concentration is perfect, but he always knows where he's at on the floor mm-hmm. and how he can make an attacking move, either for a rebound or for a bucket. Like he is so fun to watch. I really hope he gets his chance. The game that I've been playing on various subreddits is posing the question: if you wiped the Denver Nuggets entire starting lineup and they played their entire season just as the bench unit, what seed would they get in the East? And the responses have been gobstopping.
Please tell me it's nothing above a 5.
I mean, there are some people whose views on the Indiana Pacers do not need to be foretold in this podcast.
Okay. Then let's keep them where they are, buried on the dark web.
But yeah, I mean, the Nuggets have, you know, we'll go into this further in the summer, but the Nuggets have assembled a spectacular personnel group. The game that we want to play to wrap things up, though, is all of you golf fans out there. I don't know how alive or interested you were at the time, but the old PGA game at the Masters or at like the Open would be picking Tiger versus the field, you know, who's going to win. Like this was during Tiger's heyday when he was just a mutant cyborg dominating every tournament. It was like, oh, like, is it going to be one of these other 275 professional golfers or this one guy?
Louis Oosthuizen.
Yeah. Easy J Billis. Okay. And so what we want to do is we want to translate that betting format to Zion versus the field as it pertains to who's going to be the best player from this draft. So the bet is like, you either get to pick Zion or you get to pick literally everybody else who was drafted to come out as the like perennial best player historically in this field. Who do you got?
Yeah, I'm going to handicap myself and create some conditions to make this even farther. I'm going to say
a parlay bet.
I'm going to say I'm not going to be able to take anyone else drafted in the top 5. And I can only take 5 players. And so those 5 players are as follows: Jarrett Culver, Sekou Doumbouya, Nickeil Alexander-Walker, Brandon Clarke, and Cabangeli.
Okay, I want to hear some staunch rationalizations because I am frothing at the mouth.
Okay, so my idea with these 5 is that I just picked a wide variety of skill sets, of positions, of basically just picked and chose just like a smorgasbord, like a Thanksgiving dinner. I got the turkey, I got the stuff.
Cornucopia.
A cornucopia. Exactly. Thank you for delivering that masterpiece, Mr. Thesaurus over there. In Jarrett Culver, you have arguably the best playmaker in the draft aside from Ja Morant, who is able to pass the double teams, is able to find certain angles that I haven't seen in a while, and is really just like a proficient 3-point shot away from like being a franchise cornerstone in the way I see it.
I'm with you.
So that's my best bet is someone that really is just being slept on over all this rookie talk. Part of it being him not playing summer league.
Wait, hold on. Are you heaping these accolades on a Jarrett Robert Culver who the Suns traded the rights to for one Dario Saric? Is this the same player?
Yes, Jarrett Culver out of Texas Tech. Yes, that one.
Okay. Thank you. Just wanted to clarify that in my notes.
Now, Noseku, that's an absolute crapshoot. I mean, he could be out of the league in 2 years. He could be an all-star in 2 years. I have no idea. I'm not going to pretend to know. But I will say that his potential is through the goddamn roof. Will he reach it? Most likely not. But he has the potential to be better than Zion. And that's the sole reason that I threw him to the list is just the ceiling is the roof, as the great Michael Jordan said. Nickeil Alexander-Walker, for obvious reasons, after watching that summer league. I mean, he's like goddamn ambidextrous. I've never seen someone like thread the needle on one-handed passes with both hands like he did. And then all of a sudden, like, pull up with his right hand like he didn't just sling one to Jackson Hayes on a lob with his left hand. It's ridiculous what he did.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
And then Brandon Clark, like I already stated, I think he's a defensive savant. Great footwork, premier lob, throw in the pick and roll. The question mark there is, can his offensive game be expanded to the point where, you know, he can be your, like, number three guy offensively? Because you really got to develop your game to be better than Zion here. I mean, we don't know what Zion's going to be. We know he's going to be good. And so you got to be a two-way player in order to beat out Zion in the future, the way I foresee it. And then my last guy is Cabangeli. For a lot of the same reasons that I already listed previously in this podcast.
So that was a wonderful demonstration. The question remains, do you take the field or do you take Zion?
I'm going to take Zion.
Okay.
after listing off those five guys, obviously didn't include Moran, Barrett, and like, I don't care about DeAndre Hunter. I don't think he's going to be good, whatever. But
oh, well, now you don't think he's going to be good or you don't think he's going to be great? Because that's a distinction worth making.
I don't think he's going to be great.
Okay.
I don't think he has a chance to beat out Zion, even if Zion pulls a Jabari Parker and tears both ACLs over the next, like, 2 years.
Jesus. Jesus. Do you kiss your mother with that mouth?
Jeez.
Cannot believe you would speak that evil on me, Ricky Bobby. But
it's wow. This isn't a draft in what, like, with the Trae Young Doncic scenario where we're gonna see, like, I don't think we're gonna see two players being compared heavily head to head. Like, I don't think Barrett is in the same, like, ethersphere that Zion is in. I think maybe you're gonna see some giant Zion like head to head comparisons down the line, depending on how their careers play out. But yeah, my final answer is Zion over the field. All right.
Well, I mean, you kind of the handicap of not being able to use the top five makes this, you know, exponentially more challenging.
Hey, you can use the top five if you want. I'm putting myself in a precarious position.
No. I'll stick to your methodology. I got different guys though. I love Reddish. I think the spacing that Krzyzewski put together at Duke did not benefit him at all. I think for most of the year, Trey Jones struggled with his shot. Zion wasn't really a gravity shooter. Their spacing wasn't, you know, Barrett wasn't a gravity shooter, and their spacing wasn't, like, they were able to dominate off pure physical genetic talent alone.
Yeah.
You know, they actually offensively were a bit messy and ugly last year. And I think you've said it multiple times, but I'd be willing to put some coin down on Reddish transitioning into a spread out, nice, fluid system that the Hawks had Trae Young in last year. Like, I could see him absolutely flourish. And, you know, I don't think the Paul George and Bradley Beal comparisons are outlandish for him in terms of his peak if he wants it. You know, and the question has always been his motor. That'd be one of my five. I think Honestly, I think Rui is one of my five after watching him in Summer League. Now, he has zero vision. He is a black hole. He does not look up. Once he catches the ball, it is either a post move or two dribble pull up. I mean, he might not average more than 0.5 assists in his career, and his defense leaves something to be desired, but he can flat out get a bucket. He's got great touch. He's got excellent touch. I like his chances.
I don't hate that. I don't love it, but I don't hate it.
I'm gonna say Sekou, even though part of me instinctually feels like Sekou was drafted off the right mixing and editing to a Drake beat on YouTube. I for some reason I don't know if it's like a French thing or just a EuroLeague thing, but like every time Sekou finishes, it feels like this like very delicate, dainty sort of like, oh, I'm just gonna flutter up here like a fairy and drop the ball in. And he's going like 78 miles an hour, so it's like massively impressive. But then you see Brandon Clarke just tomahawk scalp somebody, like li literally just assault somebody's jugular, and you're like, wow, this feels transferable. I could see this in an 82 game season. So like I don't know, Sekou, I'm not sold, but I'll put him on there because he is one of the truly fastest coast to coast players for his size I've ever seen. Kobe White, because Kobe White's ball handling creativity is like maybe the best we've seen since Kyrie. Just the amount of deceptive quickness and like dribble combinations he's able to utilize to get to the rim. Fascinating. I could see him developing. this is where I want to say Barrett, but I'll stick out of the top five. I don't have a fifth. I like we said it before, we'll say it again. This was a weak draft in terms of top end talent, and as it pertains to the game, I still got Zion over the field.
All right, there's your conclusion, folks. Zion over the field.
Zion over the field. Thank you for listening this week. And we have a real brothel of content coming at you next week. Stay tuned and thanks for listening. Have a good week, y'all.
Thanks for tuning in to Luxury Tax. For more scalding hot takes, don't forget to follow our Twitter at The Luxury Tax, as well as the Lead Sports Media.
That's right. And tune in next week, Wednesday, for our newest installment. And make sure to keep those elbows in check at your local YMCA tomorrow. Adios, y'all.